Alan Kring Productions, in association with the Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is International Financial Management, FIL 344, for spring semester 2022.
Today, I'm working on this. Okay, people, work. Help me. Okay, yeah, we're working it out. Today, economic and translation risk. It's not a minor thing about this subject. Is that it was not. It was only a few years ago when I was teaching the economic exchange rate risk topic, and it occurred to me that what was in the book was not what I was saying in class at all. You see, the modern interpretation of the term economic exchange rate risk is not economics. It's really, I'm going to go through it with you for a little while, but it's really nothing but another version of transactions risk in exchange rates. It's the same thing, and I'm not sure how it came to be this. You see, back in the day, you've seen transaction risk. The currencies are moving against each other, and that affects the free cash flows that are coming from your foreign subsidiaries versus your domestic subsidiaries. What do you do about it? Do you hedge it? Do you just ride with it? Do you diversify the portfolio? That was what I did on Monday. Now, here in this one, well, we're going to be doing the same thing, except we're going to talk about it from the economics. And I'm not sure what they're considering economics these days. But again, back in the day, we would talk about this in more of the macro economy of these countries with which we are working. What are their economies like? Where are these economies moving in terms of, well, okay, we see a high inflation rate in this country. Well, are they going to let that keep going, or are they going to correct it? And if they're going to correct it, how aggressively, and in other cases, how? So in other words, it was more about the central bank policies, about looking at the economic indicators to tell what a country was going to do. And that meant keeping an eye on the political environment too. Look, a country cannot just, most countries are averse to fixing inflation. They don't have as many problems with causing inflation and expected inflation, but they do understand the problem of fixing it, because the way you fix it, after you've done all of the other silly things, eventually you get around to, oh, we have to drain liquidity out of the economy, and that causes interest rates to go up. That causes a recession or an economic pause. Okay, politically, that is not a good idea to do. And if you are going to do it, actually, the timing of it would be important. When is their central bank going to do it? Does the central bank support the current administration of the country? If they need to stop the inflation, they would probably prefer to do it early in an administration, so that the pain got through and then the economy was doing a nice recovery when the next election occurred. On the other hand, if they have a bias against the current administration, then you would probably expect that clamping down on the money supply, interest rates going up, exchange rates going wacko, that would happen near an election. Yeah. Exactly. Interestingly enough, although our Fed has always claimed that it is non-political, if we look at the history of Federal Reserve contractionary money policies, they almost always occur late in an administration that's Democratic and early in an administration that is Republican. The difference was, the stark, shining difference was the administration of George H.W. Bush. He was a one-term president. He was a consummate Washington insider. However, he was coming up against what a lot of Washington political hacks, including at the Federal Reserve, considered to be a neoliberal neoconservative, very pro-business, very forward-leaning in foreign policy. And so they actually, the conscious choice that we think, the Fed cracked down on the money supply right before the election of 1992. We went into a recession, and it was a famous line at the debate between Clinton and George H.W. Bush, it's the economy, stupid, you don't understand it. And Bush lost because we were dropping into a recession and he wouldn't face the fact that we were going into a recession. He couldn't stop the recession because the Fed clamped down the money supply to stop a modest inflation. But yeah, it is definitely biased. And in other countries, it has that same bias. One problem, well, I'll get into this. This is the part that is actually interesting about international finance, is that we always have to do the nuts and bolts of the exchange rate calculations and the hedging and or whatever we're going to do, portfolio of foreign subsidiaries, diversification. But at the same time, we always have to think about the economics of the different countries that we're going into and what the politics is behind those economics. We know for a fact, for example, that the politics of China is always going to be to cheat. Okay? That's morally, whatever. Ethically, who cares? We know what's going to happen. So we know that their exchange rate is always going to be abnormal compared to purchasing power parity. We know it is. And we know that even when they take moves to control inflation when this happens, they're going to lie about it, what they're doing. It's just the way they are. You can be all pissed off about it all you want. Well, we're going to do something about it. Yeah, what are you going to do? Really? As far as us as business people go, we deal with the situation on the ground. Europe is a good trading partner, a stable currency for the most part, although if it comes down to push comes to shove, Europe is going to watch out for Europe and not for the United States. Interestingly, the other side of that is a country like Japan, where the culture is a culture of non-offensiveness. If they are doing something that they would consider to be offensive to the United States, they will minimize it and they will try their best to find a way to deal with the situation without stirring up trouble. That's just the way they work. And I don't know if I ever told you the famous story of the baseball game, but that's, did I tell you the story of the baseball game? Okay, there was a game between two baseball teams. Japan is huge on baseball. The nine innings finished at 100 to 100. Yes, they had that many runs. The crowd was just going insane. It ended in perfect fairness. Well, they went into extra innings. And the top of the 10th inning, the team that was up to bat got a run. And everyone got quiet. There was no cheering, nothing. In the bottom of the ninth, the other team got a run. And then everyone goes insane again. So we went to the 11th inning. Top of the inning, the team at bat gets a run. The team at the bottom, the team came back, the other team, and got a run at the bottom of the inning. The score was 101 to 101, which is not only perfectly fair, it is also considered to be a magic number. So the referees called the game, and the fans went into a riot, which is scary when you think about Japanese going rioting on the field. That's how they work. So your dealings in Japan will be different from your dealings in the European Union. You have to recognize that the politics and the culture affect the economic environment. The economic environment differentials affect the exchange rates. So it goes down the line. That's why I love to teach this course. They don't trust me to teach it because I corrupt the students too damn much. I can't imagine why that would be. But yeah, we get to talk about things that are behind the scenes. But first I have to go through the hell that we went through in the early semester. Yeah. That's right. You see, transactions risk is a technical subject. It's like you have a tumor. Well, technically, I'm going to carve you up. But then there is the why. Oh, it's because you eat fatty foods, you drink excessively, and you have a lifestyle that we won't even talk about in this class. That shirt is evidence of it. So, yeah, so actually the transactions risk is just how we fix the machine when it breaks. Behind that is the economic, which is the one that we talk about here, the whys of what happens, and also how that precisely how that affects the issues. Now, there's one more. It's called translation risk. Now, translation risk, for God's sake, is accounting. In other words, we here in the United States imagine, well, we are the center of the world. Everyone follows us. Not anymore. The accounting standards in Europe are much different from the accounting standards in some ways than they are in the United States. And I'll get into that in one of the panels here in just a little bit. FASB, FASB 52, addresses how this is done. And it is a mess. Well, you do it this way to translate one currency to another, unless there's high inflation in this other country in which you do it this way. Well, what constitutes high inflation? They never get around to explaining what that is. So, in other words, it's like, what do we do? The answer is actually relatively, and this comes from some of my former students from long ago whom I talked to, and I've asked them about this. How do you deal with this? We deal with it by our own standards, and then we stick with those standards consistently applied, and no one ever bothers us. Oh, so you just sort of do it your way. Yes, is that how everyone does it? I don't know. Oh, okay. So let me get into that here. Now, I've got these panels up here, the dash two panels in this. VeggieNet. The dash two panels are where I've got the ones that will be for this lecture. Resources, and I'll show you, just make sure you know where this is. Exchange rate risk exposure. Okay, now as you can see, there is a series of these, 1, 2, 3, 4, which are the ones that I'm going to do today. If they have the two after them, that's today, and the other ones are from Mondays. So in this, economic exposure, which is the sensitivity of a firm's cash flows to exchange rate movements, this goes to a subject that is actually from a finance course that we don't really address here. In some finance, where I've taught finance before, they would have a course where you would see line by line in an accounting statement what the different risks are. So, for example, variable cost creates no risk for a corporation. If it's a variable cost, it creates no additional risk. And you're saying, well, why not? Because if it's a variable cost, it varies with the revenues. I need your assistance here, okay?
Can I stand up?
Yes, I need you to stand up. We're going to dance.
Oh, my God, I'm not dancing.
Okay, you can sit in your chair. Now, I want you to scoot forward with me when I back up, and then back up when I scoot forward, okay? You ready? Dun, 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 dun. Do you see how there's no risk? They're moving together. Variable risk creates no cost. However, fixed costs do create a risk, and there are two different kinds of fixed costs. The fixed operating costs, you know, your plant, property, equipment, all that is just going to be there. So that creates a risk so that I could very well slam into you because you're fixed. You're not moving. Will you please dance for God's... Okay? And then there's another fixed cost. It's your interest expense, which doesn't vary either. So there's an operating fixed cost risk, and then there is a financial fixed cost risk. And those two do create more risk. Now, what we're talking about here in this exchange rate risk, it is an operating risk. Go. Yes. Oh, God, yes. And as a matter of fact, I'll give you a sneak peek ahead on this. What this actually means is that there has to be a standard for when we mark to market. Okay, the typical, under FASB 52, you mark to market at the, you're supposed to mark to market at the date of the recording of it, of the recording of the financial statement. However, oftentimes, in practice, you will mark to market at the beginning of the quarter in which the financial statements are written for the end of the quarter. But you're absolutely right. That is a transaction, or a translation risk. And I'll mention that here in a bit. Okay, the depreciation is called reductions. If the foreign currency depreciates, then that represents a reduction in both the cash flows and the cash inflows and the outflows from that entity out there. What's happening there is now at a lower value than it was in terms of dollars. And on the other hand, foreign currency appreciating is the opposite. It elevates those. The problem with that is that how do you report that in a way that is meaningful to your shareholders and to other information constituencies? How do you say, well, we're doing really well, but the problem is that was because we happened to be in a situation where the foreign currency, the exchange rate in our foreign operations was moving favorably to improving our financial statements. And so how do we report this in a way that we are being honest with our shareholders? The answer is we can't really. We can disclose it, but is the typical shareholder going to understand that, yeah, we have a really great-looking financial statement this time, but that's because of something that may not be there next time. So we might have a boost in your net income because the exchange rate move in our foreign operations moved favorably to the dollar to make our dollar values go up. But then so our stock price goes up because, hey, look at this, they're doing better. But the next time, the exchange rates have corrected themselves or gone in the opposite direction. So there we are, and we have what looks like a terrible financial statement compared to what it was last time. Well, this company lost 5% on its earnings last quarter. Boy, is that a sucky situation for this company. It wasn't because of anything fundamental about the company. It was just because they had this foreign exchange rate exposure. And we have to report it one way or the other, no matter how we report it. It's going to have an effect on the translation. And so, yeah, let me show you just a couple of slides here on this. Now, this is just a table that gives you an overall visual idea of what's going to happen with respect to the sources of our cash. Okay, as far as revenues go, where we get money in from our foreign operations. Local sales are going to, local sales in the local markets, okay? If the impact of the foreign currency depreciation, it's going to decrease it's going to have an impact of decreasing. And what will it do for our foreign operations? It will increase our foreign operations. They'll look better, but that is at the expense of the domestic presentation. Now, if the exports are denominated in dollars and the depreciation and the currency depreciates, well, that's going to decrease our cash inflows. And if it appreciates, that will increase our dollar cash flows. Now, if our exports are denominated in a foreign currency and there's depreciation, that too will decrease our cash flows in dollar denomination. And it will increase the denomination if we're denominating in the foreign currency. Go.
With the firm's exports denominated in dollars, if it's denominated in dollars, wouldn't it have no change? Or how would that decrease?
If it's denominated in dollars, our firm's exports denominated in dollars, because we would have to buy that foreign, we would be paid in the foreign currency, and then that would come back to dollars. Yeah, it would. Good question, though. Because we have to consider that if I sell a Ford to someone in Japan, what's going to happen is that that car is going to be bought in yen. And then those yen will come back to us revalued back into dollars. Yeah. It gets awfully hairy. I'm not going to kill you on this on a final exam. Trust me. You'll see me sometimes. I can't find my own butt using both hands in a Rand McNally Road Atlas sometimes with this. But do appreciate this. I'll tell you something. I teach in Central America. Every summer, I go down there, and it's surprising how many American cars are down there. How many cars from the United States are down there, more than there are cars from Europe down there. And you think, well, why would that be? Well, because the Balboa is pegged to the dollar, so there is no risk of none of this economic risk. It's always going to be coming back to the United States. When someone buys a car, a Ford in Balboas, then that's going to come back as exactly that number of dollars. So there's no risk there. That's why we love those kinds of countries, because we don't face this kind of economic transactions risk in those denominations. But if we sell a Ford to Europe, then we're exposed to the euro going up and down against the dollar. In my derivatives class, I show an example. It was actually a real example. It was actually an actual example. It was a case study that was passed around. It was never published in Harvard, I don't think. But it was a car dealer in the United States that bought 10 high-end British cars, because he was one of those dealers that sold foreign cars to rich Americans and all that. And I mean the transactions risk, which actually was economic risk, was phenomenal on those. And that's why we used derivatives to hedge out that risk. We used derivatives. There was no question about it. And the scenario actually came out that he wasn't going to get those cars for 6 months. It was an order. It was, build these. And so by the time they were built and priced, good God. And guess what? That British manufacturer, they were not going to enter into a forward agreement. They were not going to say, well, we'll say we'll just sell these to you at so many pounds to the dollar. They weren't going to do that. They were going to ride it, because they had analyzed the situation and they knew damn well that they could benefit by waiting 6 months to bill this American dealer for the cars. Go through this panel. I'm not going to beat you up on it, like I said, on the exam, but just work your way through and think about what it is that we're saying on these. Let me take you to the next one here. I want to get to the somewhat more interesting things. Okay, now, you can run this as a regression. The percentage change in inflation-adjusted cash flows measured in the home currency. Run it as a regression. Here's your problem with doing that. Inflation adjustment. And it is ignored in the book. It is ignored in the PowerPoint. And I will say it right now. You're feeling your way in the dark, because if you use inflation figures to look at your percentage change in cash flows adjusted for inflation, you're always going to be 1 month at least, possibly 1 quarter behind, because every government reports inflation for the previous period, not for the current period. So you've got a problem there with a lag. If I used our inflation rate in the last quarter to make adjustments to free cash flows in this quarter, I'd be too low because inflation is accelerating. Now, how can you deal with that? Project where the inflation rate is going. Another way you can do it is to look at these. There are some securities that supposedly reveal the current expected inflation rate. Were you taught in any course about index bonds by the government, Treasury index bonds? They supposedly adjust the par value based upon inflation. So in other words, all bonds start with a par value of 1,000. Well, these actually move the par value up if inflation is going, if we got inflation, they would move the par value down if there's a deflation. So the par value moves with the inflation rate. Now, how do you know what the par value is? Well, the government can tell you what the par value is, but it's easier for you to just look at the yield on them and back up from the yield to see what the inflation rate would have to be for that yield and coupon to be that different based upon the par value. One way or the other, this is at best an educated guess. At worst, it's just a pipe dream that you're going to get truly inflation-adjusted free cash flows to run your regression model. Let me go on here. Now, here's an example, and it's not really hard to tell this. We're going to show a subsidiary, a U.S. business, and these are actually in millions. So the sales of the domestic company, obviously their domestic enterprise is a huge thing, and their Canadian business is a small thing. It was a company that was probing the Canadian market. It had established a presence there, and it wanted to see how well it could do, learn, which was a great thing. This company didn't go in there with its teeth out. It went in there with a small operation, established a base, got an understanding of both the sales environment up there, and also, as much as that, kudos to this company. They also made a strong effort to understand the differences between the workforce and management style in Canada versus the United States. They didn't just go in there, well, we'll all do it the American, the United States American way. They went in there small, and as you can see, it was costing them, it hurt what their costs were, but their operating expenses were nil, and interest expense was, because they were borrowing in Canadian dollars, they were issuing bonds in Canadian, and so their free cash flows kind of sucked. But they were willing to play this game for a while. Now, if you have an exchange rate of $1 Canadian is 75 cents American, U.S. dollar, then the $4 that you would have, then $4 Canadian dollars would translate into 3 American dollars at that rate, exchange rate of 1 Canadian dollar to 75 cents American, U.S. dollar. Now, on the next line, you'll see what happens if the Canadian currency goes up to 80 cents to the Canadian dollar. You can see that your sales would increase. And you would see that if it went to 85 cents American to the $1 Canadian, your sales would increase to $3.40. So there's some good news right there, is that actually we're doing well there. So we would have our U.S. sales would be $320 plus $3, $323 at the exchange rate of 1 Canadian to 75 cents U.S. They would improve to $323.20 if the exchange rate improved, if the Canadian dollar got stronger. As you can see, in this case, as the Canadian dollar appreciates against if the American dollar appreciates, then you're doing good. So now we look at the costs, and you can see that, the U.S. cost of materials isn't going to change. The Canadian cost of materials are going to go, if it's $1 equals 75 cents U.S., one Canadian dollar is 75 cents U.S., you get $150. And then if it starts, the Canadian dollar starts to get stronger, it goes to $160. And if it goes even stronger, it goes to $170. So there's the downside right there. This tells you something right there. If you're going to have foreign subsidiary operations, you are really going to have to watch out for costs of materials, because that's where you can get cooked on your bottom line. And then moving down, you can see that everything is nothing but a translation. You just do the $1 equals 0.75, $1 equals 0.8, $1 equals, one Canadian dollar equals 0.85 US. And you can go down the whole line. The upshot is that if you look at the bottom line, as the Canadian dollar gets stronger, look down there at the bottom line, what is happening to our free cash flows in U.S. dollars? It's getting damaged. And notice that that is no small amount of damage. And if you look up there and scan around, where was the pain? It was right there in those costs of materials. And it was in there, and that was one of the big ones. That was the one that was cooking their butts. That, and also, your operating expenses were where the risk was. Where was the economic risk? It was in operating expenses. That was the big damage point in all of this. Somewhere up there. But, and notice here, your interest expenses. Here's the problem with issuing in the foreign currency. If the foreign currency starts to appreciate, then that means that you're spending more money even though it doesn't look like you are. You borrowed money, you pay back in the foreign currency. As that foreign currency appreciates, that's going to absorb your money to keep up with that expense. How would you deal with that? By transactions, risk management, you would simply buy a hedge, buy something that was an interest-bearing hedge. Canadian bonds. In a case like this, what I would do is I would simply sell Canadian bonds, a futures contract. The problem with that is that you cannot tailor those contracts tightly enough to really do a decent hedge. It would have to be more of a forward contract, and those are difficult to find sometimes. Going on here, like I said, I won't beat you up too much. Now, translation. The more foreign you are, the more this is going to be a problem for you. As you step out into the world as a multinational, a true multinational, with operations everywhere, you're going to have exposure to the translation on the financial statements. How do you represent it? At what point, and I'm going to get to this in a minute, you're going to measure, obviously, in the home currency. I mean, we're going to do everything. At the end of the day, it'll all come back to dollars, okay? So there's that. At least we're not trying to figure out what all these different currencies are. The downside of it, though, is that you might be doing really good in another country, but that other country might be having a massive depreciation of its currency. Yeah, our sales went up by 10% in this West African country. Yeah, well, their currency declined by 20% against the dollar. So even though in the local currency, in the foreign currency, you have a higher value on your net income. Once it gets back here to the United States, it is going to be at a lower value. Even though you were increasing your sales, it was hurting you. Know this is a really big problem because countries have an incentive to crank up their money supplies. Give the people more money. Make them feel happy. But ultimately, what that's going to do is devalue the currency. So they're going to buy more of your stuff because they got more money in their pockets. But when you translate that back into the U.S. currency, you've been hurt by this, by the process, because their currency is devaluating, because they're inflating it, and that's why your sales are going up, is because they're giving away money to people. That's what we did here. We printed money to give to everyone, and that boosted sales. Stock markets aren't stupid. They saw sales going up, and they said, oh, yeah, this is great. It's the same all over the world. Okay, translation exposure. We have a difference between the reporting currency and the functional currency. That's what I was just talking about. There's nothing fancy about this. We are going to have everything happening in the local currency. So if we are dealing in, let's say, Ghana, it will all be in the CD. If we're dealing with another country, I had one of the students, she's not here today, she's interested in doing business in Vietnam. Vietnam has a currency called the dong. It is a weird currency, and it fluctuates rather oddly. But, okay, so the functional currency is going to be what you are in. That's why you can't just say, oh, look at the sales in CDs, or look at the sales in yuan. You have to say, what does this mean as far as sales in our currency go? So you're seeing your reports in the functional currency. As quickly as you can, get those back into the reporting currency. As they come in, make the translation right away. Yeah, and this is actually according to FASB 52. Is that you, over a reporting period from the currency, one of the ways you can do it is to simply do the weighted average of your sales. So let me explain how that would happen. Okay, let me write this down. And I'll do this for a week of sales. Local currency. What you would do is just add these up and take the add these up. I shouldn't have. 95, 147, 189, 189. I think that's right. And then you take each of these and then you would apply those weights to each one of them to get your overall sales for a period. That's the weighted average approach. That's the one that FASB says is okay. The other way, as I had already mentioned, would be to take the one that was at the beginning of the reporting period and do it that way. Another way to do it is take the weighted average on a weekly basis and then take the weight, take it from there on the first one and say that's the one that you should use for the report for a quarter or something like that. Now let me take you one more here. Is that the last one I had? There was one more I had. 30. Huh, I could have sworn I had one more that was in there. There was supposed to be one more in there. Translation. Transaction. I could have sworn I had another one in there. Okay, this one, let me pull this one up. Economic exposure. I did that one. I did that one. Yeah. I could have sworn I had another one that I had put together. Was there a 4? 5? Huh. I had another one in there, and apparently I didn't upload it. Oh, I guess that's just what the one I had, one way or the other, the FASB 52 and all of that kind of stuff. There is a problem here with the, as I had begun this. Yeah, it's just there's a blank in there that should have been, had text in it. Oh, well, nonetheless, let me take you through the last part of this, is that the reporting in another country, depending upon the country, they are going to expect reports in their country as well. You're not going to be able to say, well, let's just bring everything home and report it here, and that's the end of it. Many of the developed countries in the world say, oh, no, you don't. You are going to report in our country, too, because you are in our country. You are affecting our economy. You are affecting our competitive business environment. So we want to see your results in our country's financial reports. And not only that, we are going to expect you to report according to our standards, not according to yours. Now, over the last, there was a long period of time, and it's still true to this day, and the problem is getting much worse now, when we would not do anything like that. American standards are the standards of the world, and if they're not, they should be. Everyone follow us. And as countries have gotten more independent of us, especially the Eurozone, they're saying, no, we have our accounting standards. They are very similar in many ways to yours, but they are not the same in many ways to yours. And so we want them to be reported in our standards. Now, here's the bottom line of this as far as where we are today and where we have been. There are councils. The United Nations sponsors one council. The OECD, the Organization for Economic Development and all that, they have negotiations underway to create more and more compatibility between the countries in terms of their financial standards, their financial reports. What does that mean to us in terms of exchange rates? Not really a whole lot. We just turn everything into their dollars, or at least our subsidiary operations into their currency and report. That's all it boils down to. But it does get to be hairy in other ways. And if this is probably the only course where you might know about this. Have you been taught about UCC? UCC. Okay. You've all heard of it, or do you not remember it? Okay, Uniform Commercial Code. It is essentially a treaty among the states of the Union, of which all 49 of the 50 states are signatories, that sales of goods all follow the same rules in all of these states in terms of offer and acceptance, in terms of delivery, in terms of quality, warranty, all of that. They all follow the same set of rules. They all follow the same rules in the Uniform Code of Commercial Code, the UCC. It is an ungodly thick document, and truly you need to know only a few parts of it to be to function in business. But don't be foolish. You can get blindsided by some of the things that are in there. So, for example, in the UCC, well, we sent you that package. Well, it never got to us. Well, we sent it, so it's your problem. UCC says absolutely not. Until delivery has been accepted, it is the seller's liability. Those are the things you would see in the UCC, the Uniform Commercial Code. I went to buy a PlayStation some years ago for my daughter, and they said, well, we want to get you the warranty on this, so you need to give us your Social Security number. And I said, I'm not giving you a Social Security number. Well, you don't get the warranty then. And I simply, at the time, I drove back to my house, got my UCC, took it back, and I showed them, no, you cannot make a requirement like that on a warranty. That's under UCC, you can't. Okay, here's the upshot. UCC is our UCC. There is a version in Europe that is also embraced in Asia and in Africa, and it has some rather striking differences from our UCC. In terms of offer and acceptance, there's a dramatic one. Were you taught about offer and acceptance? Okay. Who has control of the offer? The offeror or the offeree? The offeror has control of the offer. In Europe, the offeree has control of the offer. See, as once you have made the offer in Europe, the offeree has control. But in the United States, the offeror has control. The offeror, under a certain time frame, can withdraw an offer. Well, what happens if the offeree makes an alteration? That becomes the new offer. But in the United States, in our country, once the offeree makes a new offer, then the original offer is gone. Okay? It does not exist anymore as soon as the offeree has made a counteroffer. So, in Europe, if the offeree makes an offer that the offeror rejects, then the offeree still has control of the original offer. Years ago, I bought a house, or I was going to buy a house. It was $105,000. I offered $90,000. That killed the original offer. So now there was a counteroffer. So then the homeowner countered my offer, went to $103,000. That killed my counteroffer, so there was a counteroffer, and we finally got to the point where it was at $99,500 versus $99,600, and the real estate agent just lost her shit. She just lost it. I'll give you the $100. We were having fun, and she killed joy. She wanted to eat that night or something, I don't know, get her commission. Anyway, that's all I have for you today. I thank you.